Bird populations across the world are in decline, but there's good news too. Welcome to Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. I'm Salwa Khan. People all over the world are working to protect and preserve wild habitat where bird populations thrive, and studying bird migratory patterns and more as a way to better understand their needs. My guest, Scott Wiedensahl, is an ornithologist and the distinguished author of 30 books on birds, wildlife, and the environment. His newest book, titled The Return of the Oyster Catcher, spans multiple continents and countries, where he finds stories of people doing the hard work of bird conservation. Wiedensahl says bird population declines are real, but so too are the stories of people who are not giving up hope.
We know that bird populations across North America, around the world, are in decline. North America, we know we've lost about a third of North America's birds in the last 50 years or so, since about 1970. About 2.9 billion fewer individual birds now than there were 50 years ago. So I'm not suggesting everything's great by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm also suggesting that we shouldn't just throw up our hands and give up. There's a lot that we can do. There's a lot that we have done to restore bird populations over the years. And there's a lot of roadmaps for recovery out there, examples of differences that people have made in many different parts of the world with many different kinds of birds to restore bird populations, including some that we thought were pretty much essentially lost. I mean, we've done that in North America over the last 50 years. I mean, two groups of birds whose populations have actually recovered and done much, much better during that same period when we lost so many were waterfowl, ducks and geese and swans, and also raptors. Raptor populations are up about 200% in the last 50 years, thanks to better protection, the elimination of dangerous long-lasting pesticides like DDT that were interfering with their ability to reproduce. So, I mean, there are certainly paths that we can take to bring birds back. And, the subtitle of the book is Saving Birds to Save the Planet, because a world that works for birds is going to work for everything. Birds are so ubiquitous. They're found in every corner of the world. There's 11,000 species. Their migrations span the entirety of the globe and all of the oceans. In their ecological complexity, they provide a really handy barometer for how the world is doing. And so if we can get to the point where we start to bring those bird populations back again, that's an indication to us that we're creating a world that's going to work for us as well.
So obviously you have an enduring interest in birds. How did that interest begin?
I wish I could tell you. Pretty much right out of the womb. Birders often talk about having a spark bird, which is the bird that they first saw that got them interested in birding. I don't have a spark bird. I've been doing this ever since I was a little kid. I pretty much came out of the womb with this passion for nature. My interest in birds really solidified in the years after I dropped out of college. I don't even have an undergrad degree, but I got more and more directly involved in especially raptors. I doing a lot of work with raptor rehabilitation, working with injured birds of prey, I worked for many years as a newspaper reporter, and actually as part of my job was going into schools with non-releasable raptors, talking about raptor conservation. Then I moved into more active field research, working with scientists who were doing banding and telemetry projects. I eventually got my own federal and state banding permits, started working with mostly initially diurnal raptors like hawks and eagles and falcons, but then got hooked on owls. And for the last 30 years, I've been doing owl research with ridiculously cute little northern saw-whet owls and snowy owls and a number of other species. I've just gone further and further down this rabbit hole. And especially for the last 25 or 30 years, I've been very involved in studying bird migration using some of the newest tracking technology, because we've had this absolute revolution in our ability to follow birds in some cases on an almost second by second basis and peer into their lives and understand where they're going and why they're going there, and especially That gives us the information that we need to figure out where the problems are and to start to address those threats and those problems to bring those bird populations back to full and robust health again. So it's been a great way to live a life, I've got to tell you.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan, and I'm here with Scott Wiedensahl, an ornithologist and author of more than 30 books, including his latest, which is Return of the Oyster Catcher. And for this book, you traveled all around the world and found reasons to be optimistic, because you found other people who care about birds and are doing something positive. Tell us about some of the people you met.
And I'm thinking in particular here, there's a rancher I met from southeastern Colorado, a fellow named Russell Davis, who his family has been ranching for generations on the short grass prairies of southeastern Colorado, which is not the part of Colorado you see on the travel posters. It's flat and it's dry and it's prairie and pretty arid, and back, oh goodness, now, probably more than 25 years ago, Russell was infuriated to find a young woman, a young biologist, trespassing, as it turns out, unknowingly, on the family ranch. And he didn't really pay much attention to what she was saying about how the family ranch had like this, unprecedented numbers of a rare bird called the mountain plover. All he heard was that this rare bird on his property, and the government's going to probably come in and muck it up and take over the ranch. And he threw her off the ranch. He was just terribly, terribly angry. Well, it turns out that the Weiniger Davis Ranch, their family ranch, is kind of the mother lode for this increasingly rare shorebird that rarely ever goes near the shore. It's a bird of the high deserts and high plains. It nests on bare ground. It's the color of bare earth. And it's a bird whose population's been falling for many, many, many years. And scientists have been trying to figure out why mountain plovers have become so rare and what they can do to reverse that trend. And over time, as Russell actually listened to some of the bird conservationists who were interested in studying the mountain plovers, he realized that the reason there were so many mountain plovers on their ranch was not because anybody would want to change what they were doing. They were actually ranching their property in such a way that created ideal habitat for these birds. Now, part of that was because there were prairie dogs on their ranch. And if there's one thing most ranchers hate more than the federal government, it's prairie dogs. They consider them a pest. They think they're competitors for the grass for their cattle. But in this case, the mountain plovers and the prairie dogs proved to be a blessing in disguise, because by putting the ranch under a conservation easement, which provided funding to the family after years of profound drought that had pushed them right to the brink of bankruptcy, they were able to save the family ranch. They were able to put the ranch under conservation easement to protect and maintain the plover population. Now, it was not easy when the local community found out that they were required to protect prairie dogs as part of this conservation easement. Russell was ostracized. He was socially isolated. His neighbors stopped calling him. Some members of his family were furious with him. Again, they were convinced the government was just going to sweep in there and take over the whole operation. But with time, he realized wildlife conservation doesn't have to be an either-or decision. And with time, Russell found himself undergoing a significant change of heart and becoming, really kind of an evangelist for the notion that private landowners can maintain their land in a way that supports their families, but also supports the environment.
You encountered quite a few people who are working to restore bird populations. What motivates them?
Well, it really depends on the person. Some people come at it from an inherent love of birds. I mean, that's for me, I can't imagine a world without birds. It would be just too awful to even think about, too boring to even think about. For other people, it is, birds are a means to an end in terms of, restoring ecological function and ecological complexity on a landscape. And you talk about hard work. It's hard. Conservation is hard work everywhere. One of the places where I spent some time was the Danube River Delta, where the Danube River enters the Black Sea between Romania, Moldova, and Ukraine. And even after the war started, even after Russia's full-scale invasion in February of 2022, conservation work on the Ukrainian side of the border in the Danube Delta has continued. Now, this is like kind of Europe's Everglades. It's about 1.5 million acres. It's the largest wetland area in Europe. It is home to more than 300 species of birds, including many very rare species like Dalmatian pelicans. And even though, now I did not go into, I was not on the Ukrainian side of the border, but I was staying within a third of a mile of the Ukrainian border on the Romanian side, where at night, if there's a Russian missile attack, you can hear the air raid sirens screaming over on the other side of the river in Volkova, Ukraine. And yet that has not stopped conservationists from continuing to work, both on the Romanian and the Ukrainian side of the border, pushing ahead with vital conservation work. I'm just absolutely in awe of the folks with Rewilding Romania and Rewilding Ukraine who are pushing ahead with work despite the very real physical threat of war just looming over them all the time.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan here with Scott Wiedensahl. He's an ornithologist and author of more than 30 books, the latest being Return of the Oyster Catcher. You mentioned earlier that some bird populations are actually doing well, especially waterfowl. Are there particular reasons for that?
Yes, because we as a country, we as a society, and I say we both in terms of the US and Canada, made a conscious decision in the 1980s to do that. Waterfowl populations had been crashing for years because of drought and habitat loss. And starting in the 1980s, and I'll speak here mostly on the US side, Congress passed the North America Wetlands Conservation Act, known as NACA. It was 1986, I think. And then bolstered regulations in the Farm Bill to protect wetland habitats and protect prevent them from being destroyed. We entered into the first transnational bird conservation agreement, the North American Waterfowl Management Plan in concert with Canada. That was in the late 80s and put about $1.5 billion into protecting and restoring wetland habitats. Since then, that North American Waterfowl Management Plan also includes Mexico, because these birds don't respect national boundaries. You know, a lot of the waterfowl that we see in the United States breed in Canada. A lot of the birds that breed in the U.S. and Canada winter in Mexico. So you have to look at that in the entirety of those flyways. And the results have been phenomenal. We've seen an explosion in waterfowl numbers. Now, not every species of duck is doing as well as others. And one could argue that with geese, we've maybe been a little too successful. Millions and millions of Canada geese out there, millions and millions of snow geese that are actually impacting their nesting habitat up in the Arctic. But at a time when so many groups of birds have been in decline for so long, it's good to have that reminder that when we put our minds to it, when we put time and effort and regulatory muscle and financial resources behind bird conservation, we can make a huge difference. The group of birds that are in the worst trouble in North America these days are grassland birds. If we put the same effort into restoring grassland habitats that we have into restoring and protecting wetland habitats, we could do the same thing for grassland birds that we did for waterfowl and other wetland birds. It's just a matter of having the political will to do it.
Are the bird populations that are growing in any way taking over the habitat of birds that are in decline?
You know, each species, each organism inhabits its own niche. And that's sort of a combination of its address and its job description. And so, you know, each bird species has its own ecological niche. And as one expands, unless it's a real generalist species, and there aren't that many of them, they're generally not crowding out anybody else. They're fitting into the environment in a very specific way that has, with evolution over the course of hundreds of thousands of millions of years, sort of created these slots that these species can fit into without without really competing too directly with their neighbors. If you've ever spent any time watching shorebirds at the ocean, you know, they come in all different sizes. Some are kind of short and small, and they have short legs, and some are real tall with long, skinny legs and long, skinny bills, and they've all evolved to feed in different areas on the beach at different levels on different foods. So they're avoiding that. It's called resource partitioning. That's the jargon name for it. But they're just basically making sure they stay out of each other's way, and are kind of sharing that landscape, each of them looking for food in a different place, in a different way that doesn't crowd out the others around them.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan here with Scott Wiedensahl. He's an ornithologist and author of more than 30 books. But in addition to writing about birds, you're an active field researcher. Tell us about the work you do in that role.
Oh, this is the fun part of what I get to do. The writing is my day job, but the research is the fun stuff. And as I said earlier, I really got hooked on owls some years ago. And a couple of the projects that I'm involved in now focus on owls. I oversee, even though I live in New Hampshire these days, I oversee three banding stations in Pennsylvania that we started. Well, this fall will be our 30th year of studying northern saw-whet owls, which are the smallest owl in the east. They're about as big as a soda can. And they're, if you've never seen one, Google them. They're just, you know, kind of cosmically cute little fluff balls. Also, really, really terrific predators. They're, you know, if you're a mouse, they're like your definition of your worst possible nightmare. Been working with them for years, banding them. Our team's probably banded about 15,000 over the years. When we started, they were thought to be really rare. It turns out they're actually quite common. They're just rarely seen during the daytime. And then about 13 years ago, I got involved with something called Project Snowstorm, which some colleagues of mine and I started in response to what was the biggest invasion of snowy owls into eastern North America since probably the 1920s, maybe as far back as the 1890s. This was the winter of 2013-2014. And there were just thousands and thousands of snowy owls that came down from the Canadian Arctic that year. And we kind of scrambled to get as much information about these birds as we could. And so we scraped together a little bit of funding, and we started deploying what are known as GPS GSM transmitters on these birds that basically they use these transmitters use two technologies most people are carrying around in their pocket. They communicate with the GPS satellite system overhead out in space, and they record latitude, longitude, altitude, and flight speed as frequently as every 30 seconds. And then a couple of times a week, they dial up through the cell phone network and they send us all of that telemetry data. So what we're able to do is follow these owls as they're moving around the landscape. Interestingly, up until we started doing this, there'd been very little research done on snowy owls when they come south for the winter and share the, you know, the landscape of southern Canada and the northern United States with people. And the reason for that was a lot of people just assumed that they were going to die. You know, there was this old myth that these owls were being forced south out of the Arctic by hunger, that they were starving, that they were just all probably going to starve to death when they came south. None of that is true. These big eruptions, as they're known, are usually the result of a really productive breeding season up in the Arctic, the result of a lot of food rather than a scarcity of food. We found that most of these owls are in terrific health. They generally survive the winter and go back up to the Arctic. And many of the ones that we've tagged come back year after year after year after year after year. So we get a tremendous amount of data about their you know, their movements and their migrations and their lifespans. And all of the information, all the tracking data that we collect on these snowy owls, because Project Snowstorm from the beginning has been funded entirely by small crowdfunded donations, tax-deductible donations from the public, we make all of that tracking data available. So if folks are interested, then they go to Project Snowstorm, all one word, .org, and all the data is there.
Let's go from owls to vultures. In the book, you write about vultures and their decline in India and elsewhere, and how that directly affects humans.
Scavenging birds, including vultures, are one of the most imperiled groups of birds in the world. And you hit on one of the reasons for that. We've seen massive population declines in places like South Asia, where starting in the late 1980s, a number of analgesic medications like diclofenac came off patent and became widely and inexpensively available. And if you're a farmer and you've got cows and your cows have aches and pains, they're not going to give you as much milk as a happy, pain-free cow will. So veterinarians began prescribing these analgesics to livestock, which is great for the cow and it's great for the farmer. The problem is for old world vultures, and there it's a very different evolutionary branch in the evolutionary tree than our new world vultures here in North America. But old world vultures are incredibly sensitive to compounds like diclofenac. It's astoundingly toxic to them. And so if a cow died with diclofenac in its system and vultures fed on the carcass, the vultures died. They underwent something called digestive gout, where their digestive system would kind of freeze up. And millions and millions of vultures died across India and Pakistan and Bangladesh and Tibet and Nepal, you know, that whole area. And, you know, if you suddenly take tens of millions of scavengers out of an ecosystem, suddenly there's a lot of carcasses, there's a lot of carrion that builds up. And one of the things that happened across that vulture collapse zone is that the number of feral dogs went through the roof. The number of human rabies cases went through the roof. Human life expectancy declined in those areas because there was so much more disease. You know, suddenly you didn't have vultures cleaning up the carcasses of millions and millions of dead wild and domestic animals. And so it's had a real impact on people. Now, you know, they stopped the hemorrhaging, and in many parts of South Asia now, these compounds are illegal to use for veterinary use, although they're still being used, unfortunately, illegally in some places. And vulture populations have begun a slow recovery, but it's going to take generations, if ever, for the population to build back to the millions and millions that were there before this completely accidental, unintentional, collapse of vulture populations occurred. Now, in other parts of the world, we're seeing poisoning that I wish were unintentional, but is not. This is something that's happening a lot in Africa, what's called sentinel poisoning, where if you're an elephant poacher and you shoot an elephant in a national park, the first thing that's going to alert the rangers to your poaching activity is the appearance of dozens and dozens of vultures. So they'll shoot an elephant, take its tusks, soak the carcass with strychnine or cyanide or some other poison, and when the vultures come in and start to feed, they die. And so we're seeing steady declines in vulture populations in places like Africa. In parts of Europe, vultures were almost entirely eliminated in the 19th and across much of the 20th century. Fortunately, there we've seen a really robust recovery of vulture numbers in places like Spain and Portugal, especially. Increasingly, in parts of Eastern Europe, vultures are, you know, socially quite complex animals. So they're definitely making progress.
What can the average person do to help bird populations?
One of the most important is if you have a cat, please keep it in the house. Because the single leading cause of human-related bird death in the United States is not cars, it's not wind turbines, it's not even windows, although windows are a pretty big one, and we can talk about windows in a second, but it's cats. Somewhere between 2 and 4 billion birds a year out of a population of about 20 billion birds are killed every year by cats. And so keeping your pet cat inside doesn't matter if you feed it, you know. Cats chase things just because they're cats. That's what cats do. I'm not blaming the cats, but keep your cats inside. If you have windows that you routinely find dead birds lying under the windows are they're hitting the windows. There's some simple things you can do. Birds can see in the ultraviolet range, which people can't. So you can put little, you can buy tape. There's a company in Canada called Feather Friendly. I don't have any, financial connection with them, but I've used their products and they work really well. It's just it's clear tape with these tiny little, like eighth of an inch by eighth of an inch, UV reflected squares, and you can put them on the outsides of your windows. And then remove the tape, and the little squares stay there, and it makes the whole thing look like a solid object to birds. Another thing that you can do if you drink coffee, and this is going to seem like a weird one because it doesn't seem like there's a logical connection between coffee and birds, but if you're buying your coffee in a can at the supermarket, that's sun-grown coffee. It's coming from these big industrialized coffee plantations where they've bulldozed what had been intact, biodiverse, functioning forest and planted immense stands of chemically dependent coffee. The thing is, those forests before they fell were superb habitat for birds, but they can also be a great source of coffee because the way coffee was traditionally raised in Latin America and the Caribbean, it was in what's known as traditional rustic shade coffee plantations, where the coffee shrubs are planted in the shade of the forest, where the coffee ripens slowly, it develops all kinds of complexities of flavor and aroma, and it maintains really good bird habitat for many of our neotropical migrants. These are the birds, again, like warblers and vireos and orioles and tanagers and hummingbirds that winter in the tropics. And this habitat, they either use it during their migration or in some cases, for birds like wood thrushes, that's one of their primary wintering habitats. So you can buy certified shade-grown coffee that meets really rigorous standards. And there's a bunch of certification programs out there. By far, the best one is from the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center at the National Zoo. It's called Bird Friendly Certification. They have bird friendly coffee, there's bird friendly chocolate, because you can also grow cacao for chocolate in these shade plantations that are really good for birds. And I've seen with my own two eyes the results of this in places like northern Nicaragua, where and these are mostly, I should also say, these are mostly small family farms that are raising coffee in this traditional way. So local retailers that'll be selling bird-friendly coffee. There's a number of places that you can order it online and have it shipped right to your house. It's one of the easiest ways to help save birds. And like I said, if you're buying, cheap coffee in a can, you're choosing to buy coffee that is actively destroying bird habitat. So please don't do that.
I was surprised to hear about the link between the coffee we choose to buy and bird habitat, but it's just another way in which small changes we make can have a big impact. Thanks so much to ornithologist and author Scott Wiedenthal, and thanks so much to you for listening. Our website is mothering-earth.com. Until next time, this is Salwa Khan signing off for Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. The views and opinions expressed on Mothering Earth do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of this station.